And the Brits were okay with that. City of London was okay with that. Brussels was okay with that. The factions within the United States that are loyal to those two factions were okay with that. But then when it didn't work out that way, now all of a sudden it's like, well, Europe wants kind of, the more we go through this, Europe more now wants to survive. They need to get Ukraine over and done with, but the Brits are going to go broke if they are on the hook for all the Ukrainian debt that they've guaranteed. And the sovereigntists within the American banking system are like, yeah, no, we're not doing this because there's no upside for us here. So let's back up. Let's back out of that. And now let's understand where we're coming from.
Tom Lugando, how are you?
I am good. How are you, Andy?
Did I say your last name correctly? Because a lot of
you did not, and that's okay. I never know whether I should like correct people or not, especially the first time. It's Luongo, right?
Luongo.
Just like the cult. Luongo, just like it's spelled.
Got it.
But it's a little weird.
Okay, let's spoke.
Like, what are we gonna do? Like, it's a whole lot of vowels, and the poor world has to deal with it. So.
Yeah, as I said off camera, you're piping on a cigar, and we rapped about the paper lighting up a smoke when I was chatting with him. So, smoke away. It's making me want to smoke one right here. So,
well, you know, I one could argue that I built this office simply so that I had a comfortable environment to smoke without my dogs barking in the background. One could make that argument. It wouldn't, and you wouldn't be too far from the truth. I needed a place for my drum set, but other than, you know, half of the gaming collection. So, again, like, that's I just awesome. Needed to have a place for like all of my stuff. My things.
All right.
So
yeah.
There it is.
Well, hey, I heard you're a huge fan of Czech handguns. My wife is Czech. Why are you a fan of Czech handguns?
Well, because I famously in the before time when I actually talked about this stuff a lot more. My handgun, my personal handgun of choice is a CZ-85 Combat. The CZ-75 is one of the greatest handguns ever made. It just is. It's like the Browning High Power perfected ergonomically, mechanically, and everything else. These are unbelievable. They're unbelievable handguns. They're deadly accurate. They're tight. I mean, the fit and finish on my, when I paid $5 for this thing with a satin nickel finish and like a whole nine yards, like, and ambidextrous controls and all this. I like, and it was like $485 out the door. And I'm like, and it's got fit and finish, like, you know, like a $1,500 IPSC gun, right? And, you know, competition gun. I handed it to a friend of mine when I used to work with him. Just the funnily enough, guy that I worked with who was a competition shooter. And he walked around the laboratory with his Dan Wesson on his hip. It was hilarious, right? But, and this was the kind of place that I worked at that time. We could get away with that. But I ran out to the car, brought it in. I showed it to him, and I handed him the gun. He's like, this thing's tighter than my nine. It rattles less than my 1911. I'm like,
yeah.
Stainless steel barrel. It's a gorgeous weapon. And I've had it for years, and it was the first gun I ever bought. And I swear by them. And their rifles are great. Their handguns are amazing. And it's that Czech steel. It's why the Germans invaded the Sudetenland. They wanted the Czech iron ore. They wanted that coal. Like, it's just higher quality stuff, man.
Yeah, that's a good explanation. That was funny. I was checking out prices actually literally 10 minutes ago. Yeah. And I was expecting $700 to $800 to $1,000. No, you can pick a one up on a deal at $500 to $600. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm left-handed, so I had to get the 85 combat. I had to get the 85, which was, they don't make it anymore. It was ambidextrous controls. So, cause I'm left-handed. But you know, the standard 75, you know, in all of its flavors comes, you know, with right-hand controls, but for the safety, you know, I needed ambidextrous controls cause I'm left-handed. So, you know, my gun shop, my local gun shop, friendly neighborhood gun shop, did me right. I walked in with the intention of spending like $1,200 on some boutique 1911. And because that's what all of my research and due diligence told me I should buy. And then I walked in the door and, you know, the guy over at Pickett's Weaponry down in Newbury went, you know, now you want to check out one of these, and all puns intended. And he handed me the gun and I looked at it.
this is it.
Yeah, I'll buy this one. And that was that. And, you know, it was over and done with. And like the only other handgun that, I mean, I own a couple of other handguns. I own some revolvers and whatnot. And mostly picked up during COVID, right? Like during COVID, my wife built bug out bags and I bought 5 guns. Like that's what we did during COVID, right? We were like locked in the house, didn't have anything else to do. So I bought guns and, you know, shot in the backyard a lot. Put together like a scout rifle and 22 Winchester Magnum, whole bunch of stuff, right? But like the only other like high, you know, I mean, you know, like round gun, you know, semi-automatic that I would buy would be like one of those, the Arixes are a really nice gun. So I can't remember the name of the model, but those things were amazing too. And that's an American gun. It's out of, I think it's out of, they're out of Nevada. And they're a phenomenal gun. Off, you know, off the shelf, they're just like, just ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, it's funny. I'm a halfway decent pistol shot. My eyes have gone. I'm a terrible rifle shot. I always have been. So, you know, I'm going to, you know, it is what it is. My wife used to be the good rifle shot and I was the pistol shot. So, you know,
well, we just
had different fields of fire covered. Right. Exactly.
Yeah, it's fun. So, well, let's start out with diving into it. Is you have a thesis, and I say thesis with all due respect. I just want to explore a little bit more about the financial, and correct me and please jump in, the financial reset or the financial control is really coming from Europe. Work that out for me, and where in Europe, I'm assuming this is an assumption. Is that London or Brussels or Zurich or Paris?
It's really kind of both. And as I've gotten older, or as I've gone through this and I've like worked on this idea, it's really obvious that as the closer we get to any kind of inflection point, like we are rapidly approaching that moment where something bad is going to happen. Either the war in Ukraine is going to have to either escalate or end. There's going to be a sovereign debt crisis. It's somewhere. When you reach crisis points, or when you reach inflection points, that's when you find out where everybody's differences actually lie, right? So, you know, when it was, they were all had a plan, and they were all in and they were all in cahoots on what that plan would be. And I'll get to the specifics in a second. Then the overlap of the Venn diagram of everybody's incentives, you know, you could say, okay, well, they're all here and they all meet in the middle there. And that's what we're going to do. And that was generally, hey, we're going to start a war with Russia. We're going to do, you know, we're going to get the United States to fight it after the Ukrainians are used up. And then we're going to steal all their resources, and we're going to fund the EU and all the rest of it. The question then was, and the Brits were okay with that. City of London was okay with that. Brussels was okay with that. The factions within the United States that are loyal to those two factions were okay with that. But then when it didn't work out that way, now all of a sudden it's like, well, Europe wants kind of, the more we go through this, Europe more now wants to survive. They need to get Ukraine over and done with, but the Brits are going to go broke if they are on the hook for all the Ukrainian debt that they've guaranteed. And the sovereigntists within the American banking system are like, yeah, no, we're not doing this because there's no upside for us here. So let's back up. Let's back out of that, and now let's understand where we're coming from. 3 years ago, everything was on pace, right? COVID happened 4 years ago. COVID happened. After COVID, they printed a whole bunch of money, and then they were going to push for climate change. And that's most, that push for regulation and spending to fight climate change coming out of Europe. Why? Because Europe doesn't have any collateral. Why? Because Europe doesn't have any oil or coal or uranium or anything, or natural gas. They have some, but they don't have nearly enough to run an economy of 600 million people, 700 million people. They just don't have it. So, and this is the age old European story of, we will colonize the rest of the world, pay pennies on the dollar or the euro or the pound or the franc or whatever, and then bring all those resources back to Europe and run our industrial industrial capacity and outcompete everybody. This is how Europe operated for, well, 500 years going into the 20th century until the United States became the industrial power of the world. Now, after World War II, Europe is bombed back to the Stone Ages, and we have to rebuild them. And the U.S. is okay with that because there's a massive investment opportunity there. Now, we get into, so that's all running, right? And that whole, like, that whole system is running and it's all in cahoots, right? NATO, the Cold War, the long-term goal was always, we're eventually going to deal with Russia and we're going to break Russia up. The United States adopts Britain's foreign policy starting around the Wilson administration, just before World War I, of, yes, Russia's the problem. We want their resources. How are we going to do this? Well, the Brits are absolutely the masters of the color revolution. Hell, they created it. So they created the you put soft power on the ground, you undermine the local government by empowering dissident groups and giving them money, building the thing up, taking over the media, and then eventually when you get to the right moment in time, when you've destabilized that country, either through both political and cultural destabilization as well as economic destabilization, then you wait for the right moment, you put the right people in, boom, Bob's your uncle, and you can create a revolution. It doesn't matter whether it's Egypt or Ukraine or Georgia or this one or that one. This is the plan. And it's always been this way.
And can I interrupt you real quick?
Sure.
I can interrupt. Yeah. So you said something very interesting. It's like, this is the plan to destabilize, and taking this to the Russian-Ukraine war, you have Western Europe and the U.S., if you would. They don't want to end this war, it's obvious, but there's also this war is going on and really started it is pretty much because we want Russia's assets, and that's their commodity, natural resource assets. I just want clarity. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, that's really what I'm talking about. It's like Europe wants that. The Brits have always wanted to extend the British Empire for as long as possible. Okay. When they were a maritime empire, it worked. When they were an industrial empire, it was fine. After that, they transitioned into being a financial empire. They took the wealth that they created during the first 200 years of the Bank of England, from 1694 up until the end of basically Reconstruction in the United States. When Lincoln, this is the interesting part about it. I'm no fan of Abraham Lincoln, but there's a way of looking at the United States war between the states, because it refused to call it a civil war, is that this was really a French and British color revolution attempt to split the North, to get the North and South to fight each other and split the South off and turn the South into a permanent colony of Europe. They were the raw commodity providers in the South. Europe had captured markets because of tariffs and rules and covenants and everything else. And the industrial North was angry about this. And so they put tariffs on the South in order to try and level the playing field. The goal, of course, was to strangle the American, burgeoning American industrial baby in the crib, right? And so that there was no competition between, you know, continental Europe and Britain. Makes perfect sense when you think of it in those terms. Now, Lincoln surviving, the United States surviving as one country, was a failed color revolution in a sense. It caused a civil war, caused the North and South to go to war for 5 years, and it caused the subjugation of the South by the North, and Reconstruction and all the horrors of that and all the rest of it. And in no way, matter, shape, or form am I absolving Lincoln of any of that. And my heart is still with the South. Hell, I live in the South. But I recognize that as one way of looking at the U.S. Civil War now, that in a way that I didn't even 5 years ago. So, or the war between the states. So now let's think about that. When that failed, Britain had to change strategy. For 100 years, they were our greatest enemy. Mm-hmm. And then somehow, right around the turn of the 20th century, they started to schmooze us and become our ally. So they helped put globalists in charge of the American government, starting with Wilson. We got the League of Nations, which fails. We get, you know, everything else. But we get Wilson to go in to, not Wilson, sorry, Hoover. I always get those two mixed up because they both suck. It's Herbert Hoover and the League of Nations. So take all the Wilsons, replace them with Hoover. I know my history. I always mix those two guys up. But you get Wilson gives us World War I and then saves Britain's bacon, because the Brits and the French had borrowed tremendous amount of money from the United States, from American investors, to fight World War I. And they needed the U.S. to come in at that point. And this is, I'm setting up what's happening today, in order to finally win the war and guarantee the repayment of that debt. Okay. So, and this is partially what causes, of course, what causes the Treaty of Versailles, the German hyperinflation, and that 20 years of basically German humiliation, which leads to Hitler and everything else. And there's a French general who famously said that, you know, the Treaty of Versailles wasn't an armistice. It was a 20-year ceasefire.
Right.
So we're setting that up now because my friend, my good friend, Alex Craner, who, if you haven't spoken to Alex, you should absolutely have him on the show.
I would love to.
And because what Alex figured out in recent days was, and he's published, and he and I have talked about, is that the Bank of England is on the hook as the guarantor for a lot of Ukraine's World Bank debt. Okay. And now the Bank of England, by the way, if the Bank of England loses money, guess who's on the hook to guarantee the repayment of the losses to the Bank of England? The British Parliament, the British people. So there's about somewhere around $200+ billion worth of losses on the Bank of England's balance sheet from both the gilt crisis of 2022, which cost Liz Truss her job. That was about $160 billion. And then there's about $40 to $50 billion worth of Ukraine debt that the Bank of England is guaranteeing that Ukraine has now defaulted on. As of August 1st, they defaulted on. And so the Bank of England is now in a very ugly position. And so Britain absolutely needs this war extended. We don't care about $50 billion worth of debt that the Brits, that the Ukrainians owe us. We use $50 billion every week. It doesn't matter. But for the Brits, that's literally, you know, 15% of annual GDP. It's a lot of money. And it's for them, and they're as fallen as they are, this is a problem. So they're running the same playbook, which is that the United States is going to have to come in and bail out Britain from their bad bets. Now, at the same time, BlackRock and JP Morgan and a lot of other American companies, and yes, the Rothschilds are involved in Ukraine and have guaranteed a lot of this debt as well. And they want the United States to come in and fix this problem. Meanwhile, Putin is sitting on the other side going, seen this playbook before. You guys did this to us as a revolution, which was another British color revolution. One way one could look at it. Yeah, we're not going that route. So we're not going to give you your cookie. We're not going to give you World War III. So what Putin keeps doing is taking a punch to the mouth, taking these escalations, the bombing of the Kerch Strait Bridge, the bombing of Nord Stream 2, the attack on the opera house in Moscow, the drone attack on a Moscow apartment complex just last night or the night before. Like, he's taking those he's taking those punches to the mouth, the Kursk invasion, incursion, and he's going, look, we know how to play this. We've watched them do this before.
Yeah.
And we're just not going to take the bait. We're not going to give you a moral reason to create a just war to go into to escalate and start drafting your people and everything else. And the longer this goes on, the worse the financial noose tightens around the people of the West. So that's one angle on that as of September 2024.
Let me ask a question, if you don't mind,
sure,
about this. And I'm sure. So sorry to interrupt you because I can let you go.
If you let me go, 2 hours will go by and I will have not answered the original question. So it's fair. So
I'm putting the dots together here. Mm-hmm. So when the war in Ukraine first started, and by the way, just so you know, a lot of these interviews, they do so well, but I'm not sure this one might get blacklisted by YouTube, just so you know.
I've had this conversation on YouTube 100 times. So,
okay.
So as long as we stay away
from it's not because it's not interesting.
It usually does very well, actually. just so you know, I gave 3 of these yesterday. Then none of them have ever gotten blacklisted, but we'll see what happens.
Well, we'll see. I had one that with Andrew. No, who was it? Anyways, I had one that didn't do well, and I was like, that was bang up anyway. But anyways, so long story short, correct me if I'm wrong, when this peace was on the table,
yes,
right away with Ukraine and Russia,
mm-hmm,
and you torpedoed that, was Britain, if I'm not mistaken.
But Britain and now Victoria Nuland has confirmed as of yesterday that the United States was involved in that as well.
Yeah.
Now Nuland so people like Nuland and Blinken, right? They're both Ukrainians, FYI. They're of Ukrainian extraction.
Well, you can't make this up.
No, you can't. Two, they've always mapped to U.S. neoconservatives, like the Bill Kristols, the Paul Wolfowitzes, the Rumsfeld, that neoconservative group, Project for New American Century, those guys. They've always mapped directly to Britain, to British foreign policy and British foreign policy imperatives. Obama and those guys and that whole wing of the Democrats maps more to the European Union and those globalists. They're not the same group of globalists. Okay. Like, and then within Britain, you have like the Tony Blairites and the Keir Starmers who map more to Europe than you do than say the David Camerons and the Boris Johnsons. Okay. Well, David Cameron is probably more of a European, but certainly not Boris Johnson. Okay. And then the, you know, like people like, former Defense Secretary Ben Wallace and people like that. Those are classic British neoconservatives. They are classic City of London first, everything else second kind of folks. They're okay with, you know, they're fundamentally different than those that want to reverse Brexit and go rejoin the EU. They just are, and they all, and then if they remember about neoconservatives, they always back the dominant faction in order to get what they want, because at the end of the day, they're Trotskyites, they're permanent revolutionaries, their goal is to destroy Russia, and they don't care who they graft themselves onto in order to get what they want, right? But Nuland famously said the EU when it came to the Maidan, she had a different agenda than she, all she cared about was overthrowing the Yanukovych government and installing her people, not people that the EU wanted. That's what that statement was made in context of who was going to be the guy who ran Ukraine after Yanukovych was removed. Okay. And she famously said, Yats is our guy. Well, what about the EU? Fuck the EU. That's literally the conversation, right? It's a very subtle thing. And at times they may look like they're in cahoots together. They're all pulling on the same, you know, on the same side of the tug of war, but they really aren't, because this is like a four-sided or five-sided tug of war.
Like honor among thieves, right?
Yes. Yeah. No, these and neoconservatives they have an agenda, and that agenda, which by the way, also maps nicely to Zionism, but let's just keep it in, just to make sure everybody understands. I understand all of that, and I'm not whitewashing it. I'm trying to keep it relatively clean for YouTube. Yeah. So let's now move on.
Okay, so, man, you brought up so much stuff. So two things. Two questions then, and they're almost rhetorical, but I want you to answer them.
Sure.
So I was amazed, not amazed, but I was very surprised that we're not in World War III right now with Russia. Mm. And I guess that explanation, and I want you to work that out a little bit more, but it works out why that isn't the case. That's number one. And number two is Blinken. Mm-hmm. Are the likes of Blinken, I say likes because I'm assuming, and the Obamas, but the likes of Blinken, they're the ones that are running the country, no?
Yeah, okay. So, yes. It's a little bit, you know, again, take everything I just said and now ask yourself the question, well, if the neoconservatives are the, you know, they have their agenda and Obama is nominally running the Biden administration, which he is, why would the Obama administration put a bunch of rabid neoconservatives in charge? Yeah. If they mapped to Davos, why would they put a bunch of rabid neoconservatives in charge of foreign policy, like Jake Sullivan and Blinken and Nuland and everybody else? Well, clearly, because Europe wanted this, the EU and the Davosians wanted this war with Russia. They thought they were going to win. They were going to use the war so everybody would get what they wanted. Right. And it's easy to get neoconservatives to go to war against Russia. It's easy. All you got to do is say, hey, would you like to go to war with the Russians? And they were like, yes, we would love to do that. Thursday sounds great. And of course, Putin said, how about Monday?
Yeah.
And that's the difference. And that's why the war has worked out the way it has. Now, with that in mind, it was always going to be a war on Europe's terms or Europe's goals. And Europe's goals are different than the neoconservatives. Europe just wants Russia weakened, and they want cheap. They want those things. They want the cheap energy and the cheap lithium, and they want the oil and the gas and everything else. And as Alex has pointed out, there are oil and gas and coal and lithium contracts with Ukraine going back to 2014, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of deals that were signed back in 2014 in anticipation of the Yanukovych overthrow and getting control of all of Ukraine. And the Donbass broke away. And that's where all the assets are. They're in the Sea of Azov. They're in the Eastern Black Sea. All the coal deposits are in the Donbass. All that coal that used to go to Germany now goes to China, by the way.
Right.
And because the railroads literally go from the Donbass to China.
Yep.
They've always been there. But in the past, they went to Europe because Putin's, and this is just to remind everybody, Putin's weakness is that he always saw Russia as a European country. So he always wanted to be part of the West.
Yeah.
He understood that Russia has to kind of sit in between the Chinese and the United States, and that Europe is a kind of buffer zone. And it's better for Russia to have their feet in both places and be kind of for Russia to survive. The best thing for Russia to do is to not really ally with either of them. So we sell the Germans cheap gas and oil and coal. We sell the Chinese cheap oil and cheap gas, and we do all of this, and we craft a rational security architecture for the entire continent. Hey, let's just have trade and make babies. And that's been Putin's strategy, and the West kept saying no. And it's only the Brit, and it's always come from the British, and it's always come from. And at times during the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and early and certainly up through about 9/11 and up to say 2008, the United States was pushing Europe to do what we wanted them to do. But then that worm started to turn, and the servant clearly wanted to become the master, as they thought the whole thing was going to run, and they were going to collapse all of the nation states of the West, move all the power to the UN, and then create a new overarching financial and political architecture built on the EU model, transfer to the UN, and then that's how they were going to subjugate Russia, China, and everybody else by extending the financial control, the financial control layer up to the supranational level. And at some point, they decided at Davos that they would cut the American banks out of this process.
Okay,
and
so the problem
this is where the quote unquote the thesis comes from.
Okay, so they cut the American banks out of this big problem, right?
It is. Well, think of it this way: when you talk about their push for wanting to create a CBDC, a programmable central bank digital currency, and that means that they want to do away with the commercial banking system,
right?
That the two-circle monetary transmission system would collapse into one. As opposed to going from the central banks to the commercial banks, and then from the commercial banks to you and me,
go straight to the central bank,
collapse that and make it from the central bank directly to you and me. And well, where does Wall Street fit into that? How does JP Morgan get their VIG? How does Goldman Sachs make their money? How does this one? Right. And so at some point, as much as we all hate the banksters, right? And with good reason, we should hate them for a variety of things. It is the commercial banks of the United States that built the modern West. Without the commercial banking sector of the United States, there is no modern West. There is a bombed and broken Europe that has still not recovered from World War II. There is no 1950s. There is no Cold War. And unfortunately, yes, we also had to accept the military industrial complex, the IC blob, all of these other things that are going along with it, that empowered But that's because we made the choice to embrace a new British Empire model centered in Washington as opposed to City of London. We accepted that choice.
Got
okay?
it.
Okay. That's our sin as Americans. Okay. So, okay. But at the same time, once they then turned around and said, well, we took all the capital that we sent to the United States during World Wars One and Two and built the United States with all of our money, because that's what the Europeans did. They moved all their money into the United States. They built all the factories. They built all the banks. They did all the shit. And then what to do what? To build the United States up and then throw it right back at the Russians during World War II. Nominally, we had to actually clean up their mess, which was they created Germany. They created Hitler because they created Hitler. They wanted Hitler to go fight the Russians. Hitler went, you know what? You and he attacked in both directions, and then they had to, and then we had to, we absolutely at that point had to clean everybody's mess up. And that's one version of reality on the story. I know I'm simplifying. It's they're not.
None of these
historical periods are this simple. This is one version of the of history that we never talk about, right?
Right.
So
of course,
when you look at it from that perspective, their goal was always to take all that capital and send it all back to Europe to rebuild Europe. And then when they were done, hollow out the United States, unlike the good locusts that they are, the good colonial locusts that they are, at a certain point, collapse the US and the money all flows back to Europe. And then they get to be king shit of the hill again. And they've destroyed Russia and they have all their energy. They've resubjugated the Middle East. They have all of their energy. The US is then still their gendarme, or you know, their bobbies, and they're running around Central and South America, taking out there. And that was their plan. It was always the plan. It was very obvious when the WEF came out and started saying everything that they were saying. The WEF was saying everything they were saying. We're going to do away with private property. We're going to do away with all this. We're going to do away with all that. You're going to own nothing and be happy. You're going to rent. We're going to force you to rent your life back from us for pennies on the dollar. And they're like, you know what? Fuck you. No. And I'm sorry, but Jamie Dimon, like this, I smoke these cigars. And I'm sitting there going, I'm Jamie Dimon. I'm sitting in my chair like this. And there's like John Solomon from Goldman and whoever's running Morgan today and all the rest of it. They sit around and they talk. So this Klaus Schwab guy, I think he's a little big for his fucking britches, don't you think? Yeah, I think so. And that Fink guy over at BlackRock, who's their little poodle? What's BlackRock actually worth? It checks up the balance sheet. They got about $40 billion worth of shareholder equity. Dude, that ain't shit. Like, I know. Why don't we just buy it? Why don't we just collapse that and then, like, and make Fink our bitch? How do we do that? Oh, how do we do that? We call up our friend over at the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, who works for us, and says, raise interest rates to 5.5%. Collapse these motherfuckers.
Yeah.
That's how it worked. That's what happened, folks. It's not that difficult. You just have to sit around and think like these people. And you're like, yeah, no, we're not doing it.
Okay.
And the reason that it happened was because Trump got elected.
Yeah.
And they were able to install Powell at the Fed, who was always a hawk, all during the Bernanke and Yellen years. He's sitting there going, what the hell are we doing? What is this nonsense? But he has to inherit bad Federal Reserve policy put in place by Bernanke and Yellen, and then slowly but surely extricate ourselves from this. Now we can make the argument that COVID was nothing more than a big operation to go to collapse the U.S. bond market and force the Fed back to the zero amount.
Yeah.
Get Trump to sign off on the CARES Act and spend $10 trillion and then force Powell and then run out the rest of Powell's first term and then not give him a second term.
Yeah.
Which is what they tried to do and they failed.
Yeah. Okay.
So the only reason why Powell is still in place is because Wall Street put their hand on the backs of certain people to say, don't do this. Don't do this. Don't let that happen. Don't let that happen. And we'll take care of, and we'll put Powell in for another 4 years. And then we have monetary. So you have, we're in control of monetary policy in the United States. They're in control of political policy. They need both in order to run their plan. And we're going to stop them for 5 years. And that should be long enough. 6 years. And that should be long enough. Yeah. That's the way I see it strategically.
Well, I'm glad you said that because it made me think of like going through all of this and gaming this out, if you would. And it is a game. I see it. Why would you raise interest rates for 18 months in a row? We were at pretty much at zero to what, 5.5 right now. That makes almost nothing. It does make sense. It's actually good for the greenback and blah, 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 blah. It should be done, but I'm not seeing this as people that have the highest ethics to do this. They're not doing this for the country.
They're doing it for themselves, but they're also doing it in a sense. Remember, I don't think, like, at the end of the day, JP Morgan doesn't care where they invest in a pipeline.
Right.
They don't care if it's in the Donbass. They don't care if it's in Dubuque, Iowa.
Right. Right?
They don't care. As a matter of fact, if you really listen to Jamie Dimon talk, he would rather invest in Dubuque, Iowa.
Right.
He'd rather rebuild the interstates. He'd rather rebuild the railroads. He'd rather, you know, he'd rather do it here. I don't doubt Dimon's, you know, nominal patriotism at that level. I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, there's no reason, but at the end of the day, you also have to realize that they are ruthless people who understand the lay of the land.
Yeah.
And if the political winds are shifting against them, they, in order to survive, you shift with the political winds. Yeah. When the political winds shift the other direction, then you take your opportunity.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the best way of looking at this. It's not that they're, I mean, I think, look, Jerome Powell is an 8th generation American. Okay. He traces his lineage back to the freaking Mayflower practically.
Okay.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Like, there are some people in this country who are race traitors, and there are other people who are not. I just don't think that Jerome Powell is, you know, I just don't think he's a European. I think he's a private equity guy. He believes in America. And he may be a Keynesian, right, in his economic thinking. So, okay, so he's not perfect. He's not an Austrian or not, you know, some version of Austrian. Fine. But at some point, like, Keynesianism fails and you got to do the right thing. The Fed at the zero bound is not a central bank. Daniel DiMartino and Booth makes this point all the time. She's absolutely correct about it. The Fed at the zero bound is not a central bank. It's just a euro dollar generation system. And the euro dollar system, the offshore dollar system, is the monetary policy setting agency of the world and of the dollar. And therefore, and that's what we had with Bernanke, Yellen, and to a lesser extent, even Greenspan. Now,
that's a great point.
And Powell says, I'm going to 5.5%. What's the Fed's, the one thing the Fed has, the one superpower the Fed has, and this is a point that, you know, a talking point, the way we gestated it, actually came from Dexter White, my partner in Gold, Goats, and Guns. He said, well, you know, the real punk rock is the fact that the Fed can raise interest rates. Like, you know, otherwise they're just a bunch of Euro trash, you know, there's just a flock of seagulls. Like the, you know, right? But, you know, the real punk rock. This is literally the way he put it to me one day, because we're both 80s kids. He's like, so when they're just, you know, they're just a flock of seagulls. But, you know, when they go to, if they decide to raise interest rates and they cut back on global credit, now they're the Sex Pistols. Like, you know what I mean? So, right. Seriously. And, or, you know, like, I got Jello Biafra as the freaking Fed chair, right?
That's perfect.
So when you, yeah, I mean, yeah, we are good at what we do, right? So when you think of it,
we're
that
the same
way,
age.
Yeah, well, he and I are in our you know, our mid-50s, right?
Yeah.
So when you look at it that way, all the Fed had to do was do that. So all of this, like, big euro dollar stuff that Jeff Snyder talks about, and I hate to throw Jeff under the bus, but he frankly deserves it because he didn't see the shift.
Right.
And then I have to, you know, he taught me all about the euro dollar system. And then when the shift occurred and Powell's like, no, we're destroying the leverage within the euro dollar system. And we're going to repatriate the capital back to the United States. And we're going to start aligning a federal reserve policy with a revitalized United States. That's when everything went into overdrive.
Got it.
So you get Powell is installed at the Fed in 2017. Right after that, he moves John Williams into the New York Fed. John Williams, who's the architect of SOFR, the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, is installed at the powerful New York Fed to oversee the 5-year rollout of SOFR. So part of the reason why they needed to get rid of Powell is because SOFR was going to be the law of the land by January 1, 2022. And they wanted to get rid of Powell before that happened. His term would expire before that. Put Lael Brainard in charge, kill SOFR in its crib, keep the power in LIBOR or some version, or move it from London to Frankfurt and make it Euribor. Same thing, mm-hmm. right? And at the end of the day, and then that way the United States never has control over the cost of offshore dollars. Europe remains in control of the price of offshore dollars, not us. Because all that money is over there. Yeah. And at the zero bound, you get infinite leverage within the offshore dollar system. And then you have the Bank of Japan is captured. They have to continue doing QE and go to the negative bound and everything else. So there's just all this massive, massive amount of leverage in the system. And Powell, but what got me thinking this way was when Powell raised the reverse repo payout rate 5 basis points above the Fed funds rate in June of 2021. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand what that meant at the time. I had no idea what I still had to go to Investopedia. What the fuck is a reverse repo? What's a repo? What's a reverse repo? I didn't understand any of this stuff, but I understood the euro moving 3 cents in 48 hours.
Yeah.
That's what I understood.
And that's crazy. And anyway, too.
Right. The euro went from $1.22 to $1.19 from 2 o'clock on a Wednesday to 5 o'clock on Friday that week.
Yeah.
And then technically through a one bar weekly reversal, which then turned into a monthly reversal, which then turned into a quarterly reversal. And then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, what in the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
And then I go back and I think about all the things that I'd heard in the year leading up to that. I listened to Martin Armstrong talking about how Schwab wants to get rid of the commercial banking system. And I talk and I hear, and I go back to Powell going to the Green Sea Summit 2 weeks earlier and telling Christine Lagarde, no, the Federal Reserve's job is not to make the world safe for climate change. The Federal Reserve's job is its dual mandate of stable prices and full employment. And then Lagarde was like literally fulminating, like, who is this guy that he has the right to tell me what to do? And I went, could Jerome Powell actually be a good guy in this? And I'm like doctrinaire Austrian at this point. I'm like Printer Gobert kind of guy. Like, seriously.
Yeah.
And yeah. I went, wait. And then it all just hit me like a wave, like literally over a 48-hour period. I went, if this, then that. And if this, then that. And maybe I'm wrong, but what if, well, okay, if that's going to happen, if I'm right about that, then we're going to see somebody put his hand on the back of some important senator to stop Build Back Better. Because Build Back Better was the mechanism by which they were going to force Powell back to keep Powell at the zero bound, because they print $6 trillion. They're all lying through their teeth about how it was revenue neutral. And they're like, no. And then the CBO report, there's Joe Manchin, the Kyrsten Sinema both going, well, I don't know if I want to vote for this until after I see the CBO report about how much it's going to actually cost. And Pelosi's like, we have to vote for it. And then she like lops all of these other, all three bills into one, like the debt ceiling, the Build Back Better, and the infrastructure right. bill, all into one vote. And that's a classic power move to try and blackmail squishy Republicans into voting for an increase in the debt ceiling. They really get what they wanted across the board. Mm-hmm. And then the CBO report comes out and lies, and the lies are exposed that this thing's going to cost $6 trillion over the first 2 years, but then we'll be revenue neutral after that or something like that, right?
Right.
And Joe Manchin was like, okay, I can't vote for this.
Yeah.
But Joe Manchin doesn't do that without somebody standing behind him and going, don't worry about it. Your kids aren't going to be killed. Don't worry about it. You do this, we've got your back. That doesn't happen otherwise. That's the way it works in Washington. It's all big friggin' mafia stuff.
Yeah.
And Italian, I kind of know a little bit about that. So, like, I watched The Sopranos, I'm like, this is sadly accurate. I can't watch this anymore. So, you know, once you understand how to read politics, and I understood this, I knew how to read politics. I knew how to see how the markets and the policy were then okay. But I also knew how to read politics and knew how to read the political figures. So it's a unique set of skills, I guess, that allowed me to just go, and then to be willing to go, well, maybe I'm wrong about what I saw because that's not working. So what's going on here? And so that was the generation of it all and the gestation of it all. And then after that, it was just constantly getting little confirmatory bits of data. And then every day I'd wake up and I'd look at the capital markets and I'd look at the news flow and I go, oh, look, another Manila Volcker dropped, another this dropped, another that dropped. And I kept, and by December, I'm like, oh, I'm so right about this. And when I had Danielle DiMartino Booth on my podcast that January, I got her to, in effect, confirm that I was right about this.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm good to go from here. So
I had her on a couple months ago. She's very sharp. But anyways, my point is this, and it works with your thesis. And just thinking about it, the regional bank failures, right? Let's collapse the regional banks.
Well, have we noticed that the regional banks haven't really collapsed?
Well, that's the thing, right? Work that out for me.
They were supposed to have collapsed, but
they were supposed to have collapsed.
Right. And they didn't. I mean, it's interesting that it hasn't happened, but it is interesting that four regional banks all collapsed that were regulated by the San Francisco Fed.
Yeah.
And then they were all bought by banks of the New York Fed. I wonder how that happened. And these were all turns out to be banks that were oligarch banks, you know, laundering money for George Soros and Zuckerberg and all the big tech guys to influence our elections and buy DAs and all the rest of this stuff. Like, this is what was going on.
Yeah.
FTX was executed on election night, 2022.
Right.
It woke up the next morning and the Republicans didn't, you know, there wasn't a red wave and FTX had exploded. And I was already on that story by going, all summer long, we watched all of these stable coins blow up.
Right.
I wonder who did that. I'm like, and it was then that one was really obvious because Letitia James gave Tether a slap on the wrist and let him go.
Yeah.
And all the other stable coins got destroyed. I'm like, oh, that's obvious. Another one of my patrons did a correlation analysis and found that like Bitcoin and Tether were, there was clear, like there was some clear collateralization of the repo markets happening with Bitcoin. So Bitcoin needed to stay liquid. So I just turn around and go, well, obviously Bitcoin doesn't trade against dollars. It trades against Tether. 99% of Bitcoin trades. So you got to leave one stable coin that you control. That's a sink for hundreds of billions of dollars of U.S. treasuries. Right?
Yep. Okay.
And to keep Bitcoin liquid. And that made perfect sense to me. So the Fed and that was a hypothesis back then. That's been confirmed since then.
Yeah. Okay. Tethered. So here's my last question. And again, I have two more questions. BRICS, in response to all of this, and again, we could spend 2 hours just on BRICS alone, or 2 days.
We can spend two more hours on just the whole Federal Reserve thing. Like, this is a lot. There's a lot to take in here. And I'll give you as much time as you want here. I don't have anything else going on my schedule for the rest of the day. So I've got another, we've been going about 45 minutes. If you want to go another 45, that's fine with me. I don't have a problem.
Okay. So, well, we'll go as long as we can. I mean, I do have to go somewhere in about 45 minutes, but that being said, talk to me about BRICS in response to all of this.
Well, the BRICS are, the BRICS are very simple. I keep this answer short. Russia never wanted to be thrown out of the SWIFT system.
Yeah.
They were forced. They were forced to cut deals
with China. They wanted to join
NATO. Right. Like the Russians didn't, want to create Power of Siberia 1 and 2.
Right.
Like, they didn't want to do this, but they were forced to. And the BRICS were forced into, they were forced into that, into organizing. Just like, when you think about it, like, cartels like that are not natural. OPEC is not natural. And yet somehow OPEC is now BROPEC plus. We've added Brazil and Russia. And now we've got BROPEC plus, not OPEC. Why? OPEC should have collapsed by now. But because we keep pressuring the oil markets, because we keep trying to make oil uninvestable and to destroy it, of course, the oil producers continue to respond to that pressure by coming together and defending themselves.
Great answer. Great point.
Yeah. Right. So now Russia's been doing the same thing. And that's basically what the BRICS are doing. The BRICS have been told, we don't want you as members of the dollar system unless you completely knuckle under. And they're all like, well, no, we're not going to do that. We don't have to. We're not going to. And that's fine. And we're going to leave. And so now they're just building a parallel system. And since they control the commodities flow, they control the collateral, most of the collateral being oil and gold, natural gas and coal and titanium and uranium and aluminum and everything else. And they have the manufacturing base over in China now that has never been there before. Remember, go back to my discussion about the Civil War, about the U.S. Civil War. The only industrial center of the world at that point was Europe. So everybody had to, and Europe has always acted, and the United States have always acted as we are the center Great of point. The industrial universe first. So therefore, we get to decide, we get to tell you what the price of your commodities are.
Yeah.
Right? Now, they can institute a new commodity settled system because they've got industrial powerhouses in China, the Asian Tiger Five, and around the world. So now, the dark side of globalism was that globalism sent all the capital around the world, democratized industrial production, and then now it can be bifurcated. What the assholes with the Davos crowd, whatever you want to call them, I'm now starting to just call them Evil Corp Central. Maybe I'll just start calling them the Legion of Doom because I'm a DC guy. That's not a Marvel guy. Fuck Marvel.
I'm with you.
Yeah. Okay. That over at Evil Corp Central, what they were planning on doing was doing exactly what they'd always done, which was they sent all their money into China. They built China up and they were expecting to get regulatory capture of China and then use that to undermine the CCP, undermine the Chinese system, and control China by saying, we have all your money in there. We'll threaten to pull our money out and, you know, fuck you. And then we can collapse China as we want to. This is what we've done in every other country around the world. They always thought they were going to be able to do it this time. And China refused to open their capital account. And China's refusal to open their capital account is actually why they were able to continue to do this. Meanwhile, at the same time, you know, the West was tightening the noose around themselves, tying themselves up into this debt spiral they couldn't get out of. And they kept having to run, you know, go to the zero bound and the negative bound. And China's like, well, fine, we'll just keep running our little mercantilist playbook for as long as we can. Oh my God, you're still going to let us do this for another 15 years. What are you out of your mind?
Right.
And so now, Xi comes to power, Putin comes to power. They cut deals on collateral and they start just building a parallel system because technology has reached the point where, you know, and Jim Sinclair, to you know, God's rest his soul, told everybody back in 2008-09 when Obama first started threatening the Swiss with SWIFT expulsion over their privacy. Banking privacy. He said, you go nuclear. Like, SWIFT is not a hard thing to reproduce. It's just freaking code.
Right.
It's not hard.
And that's
what everybody did. It was just a smart thing to do. And then, you know, and the more pressure and the more we sanction people, the more we use the Magnitsky Act and all the shit from Bill Browder and all those fucking assholes over at MI6, the more that pressure was used. They didn't understand, the people were doing this did not really understand that the more pressure you put on those systems, the more you're incentivizing them to build alternative systems. And that's exactly what they've done. Now, you want to kill the BRICS? Lift all the sanctions. Start acting like normal people. Stop trying to promote World War III and outcompete them.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I mean, how hard is it to outcompete the Russian economy? Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I'm massively impressed with what Putin's done and I'm, you know, and everything else. But at the end of the day, the Russian economy is not all that efficient still. It's still a hotbed of corruption and everything else. It hasn't had to reform because it's being pushed into this path.
Yeah. Okay. So my really work this out for me then is where are we at now? I mean, again, this is very 30,000 foot view. I mean, I'm saying this not with an expectation or because I don't know where we're at. Well, I do. I have an idea where we're at, but not so much what's happening tomorrow, but where are we at?
We're at the inflection point where if they know that if Trump gets reelected, he's going to start dismantling the administrative state in the United States, which is the means by which they're trying to collapse the U.S. Okay. The Brits are some number of days before they start defaulting. The markets will start looking at them going, look, guys, you've got to figure out what you're going to do here. The Ukrainians want to sue for peace. They're not being allowed to. The Russians will continue to put pressure on Ukraine by keeping the war at the current level of escalation and not responding to, these provocations by Blinken and the rest of them. China is hoping that Trump gets elected because they know that with Trump in the White House, that a deal can get cut, right, on tariffs and currencies and, you know, bond yields and investment and all the rest of it. The United States is moving towards a rebuilding and reindustrializing. We're seeing that with chip plants being built all over Arizona and Idaho and other places. It's happening. But they want it to happen. But that's happening at the same time as long as it serves Davos's purpose of creating an AI-run future, those things are, we're allowed to do that, but we're not allowed to build, a really stable electrical grid. They just want to be able to run servers and build chips and whatnot and take that capacity away from China because China refuses to play ball on that front. So someone needs to start a just war over Ukraine. They tried to turn Ukraine into a just war at the outset. Didn't work. They now need to do it for real. They still want the United States to fight that war. The Pentagon doesn't want to fight that war. Lloyd Austin's over there. Literally, I mean, you ask where we are today. Where the things that have happened in the last 48 hours tell you what's going on. The State Department, run by the Ukrainian mafia, Blinken, Nuland, and the rest of them, all want war. And so they sent Blinken and David Lammy over to Kiev to say, yeah, you can, we give you the blessing to shoot missiles deep into Moscow, into Russia. Meanwhile, Lloyd Austin meets with Zelensky at the Ramstein Air Base in Germany and says, yeah, you're not getting anything from us. So while Blinken can give you permission, we're not giving you the weapon. So you go get those weapons from the Brits or the Germans or somebody else. Olaf Scholz says, hey, oh, by the way, after Saxony and Thuringia vote basically AfD/CDU and the Green Mafia, which has been running, which Merkel and a coalition of Davos and the Brits put in charge by giving them veto power in the German upper house, Saxony and Thuringia and probably Brandenburg are going to take that veto away from the Greens, meaning that depowers them dramatically and no longer is Robert Habeck and Annalena Baerbock running Germany, but now Scholz can actually run his own government. What does that mean? Well, you saw two things have already happened. First, Scholz closed the border because he's trying to save the SPD from a wipeout in Brandenburg. The second is that he's now calling for peace talks with Russia at the table. Which has never happened before. So clearly, the EU has decided to start moving, as Germany is a proxy for the EU, has started to move away from active war with Ukraine, and they just want to now build back better in Europe. And that's why Mario Draghi came out yesterday with his big thing, saying we need to spend $800 billion a year for the next 20 years to rebuild Europe. France and Germany want their own military industrial complex in a post-NATO world, where they're no longer part of NATO, and the Brits are being left. And so then the neocons are having to go trundle off to Kiev to try and keep their dreams of World War III alive. Whereas, so this is what I meant at the beginning, that everybody's incentives look like they're the same at the outset, but it's like they're like ships that pass the night on the Venn diagram. Like where one's moving in this direction, another moving in that direction for a period of time, they're all over the target, but then once they don't reach the target, now they're still doing their thing. And now they're working across purposes. And you're starting to see the beginnings of that. That's where we are right now. There's still the possibility that the whole thing still collapses because now what comes in the focus. Putin's smartly running this as a war of attrition to expend all the political and economic and social capital of the governments in the West for fighting the war in Ukraine by just running a war of attrition and just grinding this thing out the way Russians always fight war. The Russians know how to fight war in Ukraine. It's you just grind it out until there's nobody left.
That's what they always done too.
They know, like telling, you know, thinking that you were going to blitzkrieg across Russia, like the Germans couldn't do it. Napoleon right. couldn't do it.
Yep.
Ukraine was never going to do it.
Yeah.
Like Putin would have just nuked the entire friggin' Donbass if he thought that was going to happen. Like it was never going to happen, which is why he went first. So he put NATO on the defensive, having to retake territory that they never expected to have to take in the first place. We expected to go in with a lightning strike, attack the Donbass, attack Crimea, and win.
Yeah.
And Putin beat us to the punch because Putin's not stupid. He's been in the martial arts ring before. He knows that if you want to score that point, you go first.
Yeah.
Like it's not tough. And I've been in the martial arts ring. I know what that looks like. And you want to win that fight, that's how you do it. You go first. When you know the fight's inevitable, you set the terms of the engagement. Very Sun Tzu, very simple. And then if you don't get everything you want, which he didn't get the decapitation strike against Kiev, fine. Then you pull everything back and you settle into a long, ugly, slow, grind it out, war of attrition, and you bleed them white. Meanwhile, you continue. Now, is this costing Russia? Of course it is. Is it? And the West thinks that it can still bleed Russia white. At least the neocons still think that. They're wrong. And because the Russians aren't acting by themselves anymore, which is now why we're, of course, now trying to put sanctions on Chinese banks to get them to stop supporting Russia's war machine, blah, 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 blah. And if we do that and Kamala Harris wins, she's going to do that. Okay. And then we're going to be forced into a situation where this could get, you know, someone is going to escalate this. And, but at the same time, the Pentagon's like, we can't fight this war that you want us to fight.
Right.
Like we can barely field the two aircraft carriers that are currently in the Gulf supporting Israel.
Yeah.
Like we don't have the supply lines like we had in the past. And it's not about big military lift anymore. It's about drones. It's about drone warfare and everything else. And that's what we've come. And so the Pentagon knows this. And it's not like we can't produce drones, right? It's not like we couldn't do this, but
we're looking at that. Yeah.
Well, what are we looking at then? What we're looking at some point, you know, everybody's just going to have, this thing's just going to continue to grind on until somebody finally steps in and goes, that's enough. So I don't know how this plays out beyond that. I always have Martin Armstrong in the back of my head saying, this is going to be the last election we have in the U.S.
Who's saying that? Simon Hunt said the same thing.
I've been prepping for the end of the United States since, I don't know, 2005 personally, right? You know, I used to draw up maps when I worked in private industry, like as a hobby. I was like, okay, how would the country break up? I had to like break it up into seven different countries, for Christ's sake. The point of all of this, of everything I've said today, if you tie everything that I've said into a big bow in the TLDR, it's what I've been saying for 3 years. The target is the U.S. bond market.
Yes.
The target is the U.S. bond market. If you can destroy the U.S. Treasury market, if you can break the United States up so that everybody's fighting over who guarantees the debt, then that capital leaves the United States and goes other places.
Yeah.
Europe is trying to set it up so that it goes there. Mm-hmm. China is sitting there going, we'll take it, but we're not ready. I mean, we could be ready for it, but we don't want to be ready for it. This is not a world that any of us really want. So where does that capital go? And this is why I'm like, while the United States has been pushed into this moment of irreconcilable differences between the Wokenista left and the MAGATARD right, nominally, the real power that exists in the US is saying no. Because they understand that's the banking cartel, that's the MIC, that's the, it's the bigger problem here is the, even the IC blob has to realize that if this is broke, that if this breaks, where's the money going to come from to continue to do what you're doing? Because it's not going to be there unless, of course, you think you're going to be able to push everybody into 15-minute cities and make us eat bugs and put all of our money and just steal all of our money and put it on our phones. And good news for you, that's just not going to happen. What we'll wind up with is a very ugly, authoritarian future that is a hodgepodge of all of the things that Davos has like kind of laid out for us. And none of that is going to be none of that is going to be good for anyone. And so in the end of the day, I really do think Trump is going to wind up not only challenging and winning in some way, whatever that, I don't know what that word looks like. You know, I can't define what winning looks like in this scenario because it's not going to be on election night, right? He's not going to win the election on November 5th. Okay. He may declare victory, but so is Kamala Harris. They're both going to declare victory and they're both going to declare that the election's invalid. And I don't see the election and being resolved until at least January, if not later. And there's going to be a lot of ugly stuff that happens between now and then. And they have their plans for it, right? What I expect is I expect a liquidity crisis somewhere. I expect a false flag to support that liquidity crisis. And I expect unbelievable levels of perfidy. And beyond that, I don't know what the outcome of all that is, right? I can't predict that. No one can predict that, to be honest with you. So,
well,
because there's too many variables, there's too much chaos. But I know who's backing each side now, and you can see them making their moves to win. I don't know who's going to win. And this gets down to, I could make a dumb board game reference and go, this is like a game of Agricola, and it's going to be, I'm sitting there, do I go for the first player marker so I can go first next turn so that I can get to the 3-wood spot before the other guy does? Or do I just take the 4-wood that's on the spot now and try and make the best of it? I don't know, because I can't see that far ahead. Like, it's one of those weird moments, right? And that's the best I can do for you. For those of you who've ever played Agricola, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And for the three people in the audience who have.
Like, no, well, I'll take it. And I really do see it as a board game, if you would. And there's multiple outcomes. And it's just impossible to say what exactly is the outcome.
Maybe the better way of looking at it is that you're playing a game that has hidden information. Like, I should go for that spot now, but I don't know what cards you have in your hand.
Yeah.
Right. And what cards could you play to counter me? And I think I have an idea of what cards you have, but if you have that card, I'm fucked. And if you don't have that card, I win. And that, I think that's kind of where we are. And everybody is like trying to figure out, you know, can I go for the win now or not? And I have an even more esoteric game that actually models that much, much better, but that's a different discussion for a different day.
So we'll end on that. But Simon, let me say, Simon Hunt, I had him on. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He's still on similar things as you did, as well as Dave Cullum had him on. He sounded very similar. So it was interesting. But Tom, I'm a huge fan of your work. If people want to reach out to you and go to your website, go ahead and give that to us.
Sure. It's you can go to tomluongo.me or goldgoatsandguns.com. They go to the same place. You can follow me on Twitter at TFL1728. My DMs are open. So if somebody needs to get a hold of me for whatever reason, you just do so. I may or may not respond depending on what you ask. Then of course there's the Patreon, which is how we make a living, at Patreon.com/goldgoatsandguns. I do twice weekly market reports on Wednesdays and Sundays where I go over the state of the markets as well as, my look ahead as to what I think is I'm seeing in the zeitgeist on every Wednesday and every Sunday, as well as the monthly newsletter where we have a whole portfolio strategy and we look ahead as to where we're going next. And that's where the that's where the look ahead goes. And then sometimes I do private blog posts and private podcasts and whatnot. But for the most part, you know, right now I'm trying to save my energy for what's going to happen after November, to be honest with you.
So. Yeah. Well, I would thank you so much for your energy. I immensely enjoyed that. I immensely enjoyed it.
Good. I'm glad it was fun. I enjoyed it. I love the weird part about this, Andy, is that I love talking about this stuff. I can tell,
but it's good though, too. It's really good because I enjoy listening.
Well, and the other thing about it is that the more you talk it, the more you talk through it, and the more people ask you certain questions to clarify, then new ideas pop into your head. I've done many podcasts where I stop and I go,
Got it.
And then it happens in real time, and it's really cool. So,
Well, that's what happened to me now. It's like regional banks.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, the last point about the regional bank thing is that Powell put things in place to help smooth that over. Yeah. And, you know, those holes in their balance sheets over. And he set up a virtuous cycle to allow the money to come back in to the regional banks and allow them to capitalize themselves slowly without bailing them out.
Yeah.
And that is the real trick. And that's not that they're in trouble. They still have troubles. They're still going to take time to work off those holes in their balance sheet. He's going to cut interest rates here, I think mildly. And then we'll see what he does. And then we'll see what happens after that.
Yep. All right, Tom, thank you so much for your time.
Take care, Andy. Be well.
You bet.